What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. We're celebrating Thanksgiving this week with a look back at some of the under-the-radar cinematic gems that we're most grateful for this year. Movies that might just earn the coveted Film Spotting Golden Brick Award.
One day, the storm's gonna blow, the ground's gonna sink, and the water's gonna rise up so high, there ain't gonna be no bathtub. Just a whole bunch of water.
That's a scene from Beasts of the Southern Wild. We'll replay our review with special guests A.O. Scott from the New York Times and Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. And we'll revisit Adam's conversation with the director of Your Sister's Sister, Lynn Shelton.
It's our Golden Brick preview special ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is presented by the new Squarespace, where you can find every tool you need to create a high-quality website or blog. There's no credit card required to try it out. Simply go to squarespace.com/film and start your free trial. Make sure to use the offer code FILM11 when you purchase for a 10% discount. That's squarespace.com and offer code FILM11. We're also very pleased this week to be presented by Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. We've been talking about Shutterstock the past couple of shows here on Film Spotting. Got some more recommendations that have come in via the Film Spotting Facebook page. Jordan Lebrecht says, I work for a magazine and use Shutterstock all the time. Great prices and good package deals. I'll definitely use your code now. We also heard from a listener named Ricardo who says, I've never actually used Shutterstock before, but thanks to your suggestion, I'll be sure to use it in the future. I only wish I'd known about it before. I often help illustrate articles on websites, and it's impossible to always take original photographs. Thanks so much to Ricardo and Jordan for those thoughts. If you have a testimonial for Shutterstock, please feel free to share it with us by emailing us feedback@filmspotting.net or go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmspotting. But whether it's for your website, an advertisement, or a multimedia presentation, whatever the film project is, you can choose from over 700,000 high-quality stock video clips at Shutterstock. They come in a variety of digital formats, and most come in HD. They have really sophisticated search tools, so you can search and drill down by category, clip, resolution, contributor, and HD. They have really sophisticated search tools, so you can search and drill down by category, clip, resolution, contributor, and more. And they have excellent customer service with dedicated reps and 24-hour support throughout the week. They also have flexible pricing, so you can choose individual clips or video packs. If you want to try Shutterstock out today, you can sign up for a free account now. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like and save video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM11 and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com and offer code FILM11 for 30% off new accounts. We thank Shutterstock for their support of Film Spotting. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're going to highlight some of the top contenders for Film Spotting's Golden Brick. This is an award segment we do every year. We highlight five nominees and then pick a winner, basically choosing from films that we thought were a little bit more obscure, maybe overlooked throughout the year by a lot of filmgoers, but that we appreciated and wanted to help get more exposure for. The name Golden Brick actually comes from Rian Johnson and his debut film, Brick, which was a movie that Film Spotting championed very early on. Previous winners of the Golden Brick are Moon from Duncan Jones, the Greek film Dogtooth, and last year we had kind of a co-winner, the listener's choice pick, Take Shelter from director Jeff Nichols, and our pick, The Arbor, an experimental documentary. So this year, we've never done this before, Josh, where we've kind of given listeners a preview of some of those contenders, but we thought it made sense not only to give our listeners a chance to check these movies out if they haven't seen them already, but maybe give us a chance as well to take stock of where we're at so far.
Yeah, and it's really helpful to hear from listeners because part of the award is the film that listeners appreciated
exactly.
Because they heard about it here on the show, and sometimes it's hard to gauge that just being on this end. So hearing what people really appreciated from earlier in the year is really helpful.
Yeah, and that's exactly the question we posed to listeners to cull these contenders. We asked them to weigh in via Twitter and Facebook, basically just picking the movie they really enjoyed that they probably wouldn't have seen or maybe even heard anything about if it wasn't for Film Spotting. Not all of these films we're going to list got a full review on the show, but all were mentioned at some point this year, whether it was a quick review or they made a top five list, or maybe the actor or director was interviewed on the show. It's worth noting about these early contenders that they were not necessarily favorably reviewed or recommended by both of us.
Right.
That is a requirement for the Golden Brick nominees. But for these early contenders, we can certainly talk about movies that at least one of us liked a lot.
So we're going to have to find about five movies we can agree on in this category?
I think we can do it, Josh.
You think we can?
I think we can do it. Why don't we go ahead and list these titles, and we'll also list them at filmspotting.net with details on how you can see them for the ones that are currently out on DVD or available via streaming. We've grouped them together here because a few of them did fit into some nice little categories, including foreign films, for example. We have two of those.
Once Upon a Time in Anatolia and Oslo, August 31, which
the Norwegian film
still have to catch up with, actually.
Yeah, that's a really good film that I think I maybe only got to recommend on Twitter and briefly mention on the show, but a film I am definitely a fan of. And Once Upon a Time in Anatolia is the Turkish film that we were both very enthusiastic
about.
Love
that movie.
And I think it's one that you can see via streaming if you haven't caught up with it yet. We also have two docs.
How to Survive a Plague, which you talked about just recently, and then Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
Yeah, the film about the world's best sushi maker, and How to Survive a Plague is a really fascinating documentary about ACT UP and some of those early gay activist groups that were integral in battling the AIDS virus and helping spur the medical community along and coming up with the proper medications. Both really interesting films. We also have two horror movies.
The horror category is Cabin in the Woods, which I had forgotten about but actually really liked, and The Innkeepers, so-so on that
one. You were more mixed on that, but that's one definitely listeners said that Ty West film is one they never would have seen and enjoyed if it wasn't for our review. And Cabin in the Woods, I thought was maybe too big of a movie. It comes from the Joss Whedon world, and I thought it was one sort of everybody knew, but it was a very popular choice on social media.
I think people expected it to be big. It didn't really happen.
No, that's
so
true.
Now folks have to catch up with it. In the romances category, we're including Your Sister's Sister and The Deep Blue Sea.
Yeah, Terrence Davies' film with two really good performances, I think, from Tom Hiddleston and Rachel Weisz. We also have two movies that deal with murder.
Movies about murder. Bernie and Killer Joe.
Yeah, William Friedkin's film. And Bernie features a really great performance from Jack Black, a little bit of a surprise from him. More dramatic, maybe, but also features some of those characteristics of Jack Black you're used to seeing. He's a larger-than-life personality in that film. Gets to sing a little bit as well.
Just watch that again, and he is excellent. And his name's going to come up on year-end lists, I think, at least for me.
We also have two movies that come from our friends in the Great White North.
Goon, which I still have yet to see. Looking forward to that one. And Sarah Polley's Take This Waltz.
Yeah, that was one I lean more positive, definitely, than you. Mm-hmm. It's her follow-up film to Away From Her. I think there's enough interesting things going on in Take This Waltz that it warrants a mention here for a possible Golden Brick. We also have two films here from directors making their sophomore efforts.
Martin McDonagh's Seven Psychopaths and Craig Zobel's Compliance.
Yeah, that's a really challenging, divisive film that some listeners did see after hearing our interview with Craig Zobel. And also, Martin McDonagh was featured on the show with Seven Psychopaths. A lot of fans out there for In Bruges. I think In Bruges is probably a better film, but there are elements of Seven Psychopaths I really love. So that brings us to our final batch here. Three movies that come not from sophomore filmmakers, but from first-time filmmakers.
Sleepwalk With Me, Safety Not Guaranteed, and my choice for film of the year so far. Still have a bunch to catch up with, but Beasts of the Southern Wild.
That will be interesting to see if Beasts of the Southern Wild is eventually supplanted by another film. It's been your number one of the year, Josh, since we saw it and discussed it in July. And that was a really great segment for us because not only did we get into the film pretty in depth, but we had the pleasure of reuniting the one time at the movies tandem of Michael Phillips and A.O. Scott from the New York Times to get their passionate but divergent takes.
And it all goes quiet behind my eyes. I see everything that made me.
Pieces, pieces.
Flying around in invisible pieces. I see that I'm a little piece of a big, big universe.
In a bad time, I promise that.
In a million years, when kids go to school, they're gonna know. Once there was a hush puppy, and she lived with her daddy in the bathtub.
This is Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. And that was the trailer for Ben Zeitlin's Beasts of the Southern Wild, winner of the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance and the Camera d'Or for Best First Film at Cannes. Beast has, since opening in New York and L.A. on June 27th, emerged as arguably the most divisive film of the year. On one side of the bayou are critics hailing it an inventive, impressive American debut, a work of, quote, creative genius, according to Roger Ebert. On the other side are critics decrying its slick and perhaps even exploitative pretensions. In response to Michael Phillips' negative review in the Chicago Tribune a few weeks ago, A.O. Scott unleashed this tweet directed at his former At the Movies partner. Where are the cameras? I want to tape a show with Phillips Tribune now. It would be one hell of a fight. This bout, alas, is not televised, but the two heavyweights accepted our offer to come on for a beast battle. Here with us in Chicago is regular Film Spotting contributor and guest host, Michael Phillips. Michael, thanks for coming on.
All right. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here, Adam.
Fantastic. And joining us by phone from New York, he and Manola Dargis are the chief film critics for The New York Times. A.O. Scott, Tony, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's great to be here. It's wonderful to, you know, to demand satisfaction and then get it.
There you go. It really is a thrill to be able to reunite you two as well. Since you're the newcomer to the show, Tony, we'll start with you.
Okay.
Beasts of the Southern Wild is the story of a six-year-old girl named Hush Puppy living and struggling to survive post-Katrina with her sick father in an isolated patch of New Orleans Delta dubbed the Bathtub. It's a visually eclectic bit of magically realist Americana that I can most easily sum up as Terrence Malick meets Maurice Sendak. And I love the close to your Times review, Tony. You wrote, "Discovering this movie is like stumbling into a bar and encountering a band you've never heard of playing a kind of music that you can't quite identify. Nor can you figure out how the musicians learned to play the way they do with such fire and mastery. Did they pick it up from their grandparents, study at a conservatory, watch instructional videos on the internet, or just somehow make it all up? Are you witnessing the blossoming of authenticity or the triumph of artifice?" Explain your answer to that question and make your case for the film.
Well, I think that this movie works on a kind of wonderfully visceral and emotional level, if it works for you, and it certainly worked for me. That is, a lot of critics, I think, both pro and con, have kind of picked at the authenticity or the genuineness of it, and you know, who are the filmmakers and what is their relationship to the world that they're depicting, the characters and the non-professional actors they're using. And I think that this is, like a lot of great works of American imagination, a hybrid. It's an intellectual construct, and it's also an explosion of feeling. It's the discovery of a new world that's partly a real world and partly an imaginary world. And the thing, all of the elements of it, the neo-realist elements, the magic realist elements, the music, the monsters, the kind of somewhat chaotic mise-en-scene, you know, all of the sort of rushing handheld camera work and these kind of beautiful mythical set pieces, all for me just work together into something that just felt very new and fresh and wonderful. It just moved me in a way, transported me in a way that very few films recently, and certainly not, I think, not many first features from young American directors have in the last few years. I just felt like there was this drive that Ben Zeitlin and his co-screenwriter, Lucy Alibar, felt to go out maybe of themselves and their immediate circle and their, you know, immediate personal concerns and discover something or invent something out there in the world.
Now, Michael, in total honesty here, your two-star review was certainly not as vitriolic as some others, but we need you to be the villain here on the show. So what's your case against Beasts of the Southern Wild?
Not my case against it is every time I hear the film described, as Tony just did, it's a film I dearly would have loved to have seen, and I can see how others experience that way, because it is, and it is not in any way a sloppy or ill-considered film, but it's a rush of feeling. It is much more about a swirl of visceral emotion than, you know, any kind of neat narrative track. It's not after that kind of thing. I also don't understand the people that write it off completely on a political level, which I know Tony and I've heard a lot about, and other people have read about all over, you know, from Twitter on up, in that they find it kind of a reactionary or, you know, kind of a libertarian dream of, you know, this community that just wants the government off its back. And, you know, to me, that's nonsense, because it's a portrait of a isolated community in crisis that really isn't about politics of any kind. where I just couldn't get on board was, to me, that wash of feeling, that rush of sort of that swirling handheld sort of document, I hate to use this phrase, but documentary style imagery, to me it just became dramatically monotonous, and I thought the film had absolutely no kind of peaks and valleys to it. So it was almost kind of a mechanical resistance to it, of just like, come on, give these characters we're trying to get to know a little breathing room. You know, I found, and I do find that young actress terrific, but I think all the deserved attention on the young actress, who was 5 when she was cast and 6 when it was filmed, is taking the attention away and the heat off a big hole in the film for me, which was Dwight Henry as Wink. And, you know, a non-actor, admittedly, but, you know, I think he could have been told to just find a different way to read a line instead of just yelling and screaming everything. And a lot of that's a little bit of a fault in the writing, in that it's a haranguing kind of role. And I found the film visually a bit of a harangue, frankly. And I just couldn't get close enough on one hand, and I couldn't get enough distance from it in another. And I don't like the way he scores his film either. And he's a co-composer, Ben Zeidlin. He's a very talented guy and admittedly talented filmmaker, very impressive first feature. But I hate the way he overscores this picture and kind of has his fingers around the throat of the film with the score, cueing you every single moment on what kind of emotion to feel.
It's Film Spotting. That was guest Michael Phillips with his case against the new film, Beasts of the Southern Wild. A.O. Scott from the New York Times is joining us by phone. Well, Josh, you've waited patiently to get a word in, but anyone who heard our top 5 films of 2012 so far knows that you're in the bag for this film. You had it at number 1.
I did, and there is a lot of technique and craft at work here that is doing something on a level beyond just an emotional response. Now, at the same time, Michael, you said, I dearly would have loved to have seen this movie that everyone's excited about. I would have loved for you to have seen that movie too, because when I hear people who have not appreciated it, I don't begrudge them that. It does have this sort of instinctual response that you have to it, but I do feel sorry for them because this is such...
You pity me?
I pity you for not liking Beasts of the Southern Wild. This is such an experience. It's so much audacious creativity going on here. How often can we say, I've never seen anything like that? And that happens with this film. When we're watching movies that so often do the same things over and over, here is something that, even though it has its faults, and the Dwight Henry performance, I'll admit, does have some scenes where he needs to be pulled back, but I put him on my list of top 5 performances so far because he also has these scenes that are just powerhouse. He's loud, he's screaming, that's right, because the guy's in a panic. I did like that performance. There were so many things going on here. I think political readings are incorrect. I would agree with that. But I really liked how it did have those tendrils going out to the real world. So we not only get Katrina, but you have references to the BP oil spill, the melting polar ice caps. It's not that it's making a statement about any of those things, but it's tapping into this general anxiety and unease in the real world where this is all going on and connecting to this magical fairy tale type place.
They think we all gonna drown down here, but we ain't going nowhere. Holidays than the whole rest of the world.
The one thing I would say, though, is that there's something about the cumulative effect of the way he shoots and edits and scores this, you know, very kind of handmade, homegrown, earnest film that reminds me of a BP oil spill cleanup commercial. I mean, it's got something, and this, I guess, links me to the other people who say there's something slightly dubious about the technique of the film. It just links it to a kind of a...
What are the moments, though, that... Is it the parading prehistoric creatures that a BP commercial
would have?
There's so much originality. What are the moments that remind you of a BP commercial? Something that would be slick and familiar and manipulative.
I think sometimes the celebration of a community, under fire, isolated, survivalists to the core, good American virtues and values and all that, it all seems a little...
All scored to music.
All scored heavily to music, there's a ton of filmmaking assurance behind every decision, and I just somehow, it never felt spontaneous and of the moment to me. It felt a little too fussed over and just frankly dramatically monotonous. I guess that's my issue with it. And I wish You know, I'll give it another look someday, and just to see exactly.
You want to be as happy as we are. That's what it, you want to enjoy it as much.
I question if Josh deep down is really happy. So.
It's also very sad. I mean, it is a movie about facing devastating catastrophe and the loss of home. I mean, a girl who's lost, whose mother has vanished, whose father is dying, whose entire world that she's known is being swept away, and she's asserting a kind of defiance in the face of this. And I think the problem with the political readings of it is that they don't give enough credence to the kind of primal force of that defiance, and also the extent to which it's a kind of wishful thinking. This is a movie about how a child sees the world. A child is going to magically rediscover her mother, who's going to serve her fried alligator. A child is going to imagine she can face down the monsters. A child is going to imagine that, you know, 1,000 years from now, everyone is going to know who she was. And there's something really both stirring and heartbreaking about that perception of the world. And one thing that I do like about this movie, to circle back to the politics, I don't think it's a disengaged or apolitical movie. One of the things that I really like about it is that it kind of generously opens itself to both a left-wing and a right-wing reading. You know, you can read it mm-hmm. as a sort of parable of you know, don't tread on me individualism, and you can also read it as a parable of multicultural community
it's the one thing it has in common with The Dark Knight Rises. It's politically very slippery, I think.
Well, after the unbridled enthusiasm there of Josh and Tony and Michael's cynicism, I'll try to kind of split this right down the middle a little bit. Certainly, if I'm going to give a pass to Sarah Polley for some of the bold choices she made in the mostly absurd Take This Waltz, which I did do recently here on the show, I've got to admire what Ben Zeitlin's doing artistically here. Josh, you're right. It is audacious, and I respect that. And Terrence Malick is an easy reference to make, but you can't help it. Michael, as you said, with Days of Heaven, the voiceover instantly recalls that film. But even more for me, it made me think of the sweet naivete of Sissy Spacek in Badlands. And the same qualities that really grabbed me with The Tree of Life are what grabbed me here. This movie is shot on Super 16mm, and the camera is constantly roaming. It's seeking new information. It's kind of like when you watch old home movies, and the person running the camera has no idea where the action is going and just follows it. I really like that. I love the nerve that Malick has as well of putting this young girl and putting this family in this community's plight in this larger cosmological context. And I haven't mentioned yet the other big thing that worked for me. It is that lead performance of Quvenzhané Wallace. I feel like I have to watch this movie 4 or 5 more times to even really adequately try to sum up what she's doing. I don't really know how to describe what she's doing.
She's wonderful in it. And the one thing I would say that Zeitlin had a great instinct for with this, his first feature, is exactly how much, quote, acting to get out of a 6-year-old.
Right.
Just like the Dardan brothers with the kid with the bike, mm-hmm. which is certainly one of the best films I've seen in the last year. I think the young, who was 11 or 12 at the time, maybe 13, Tomas Doré plays the young, very troubled young boy in that. And that similarly, you have there's a quality of authenticity in that work that works for you, whether or not the film does. And I guess I just find that Zeitlin's, it's a hammering technique of a crisis-laden situation, and I just felt like I needed a little more breathing room in there to fully experience and get close to characters mm-hmm. that are more than just emblems of a crisis or something.
Well,
that's how I felt. I don't know. I'm not looking for an entirely different style. It's not like I'm looking for an entirely different attack. I'm just looking for less of an attack.
I mean, it was one of the things that I really liked about it was it was taking some of the kind of socially conscious regional realism that's been a hallmark and some would say a limitation of American independent film, especially of the Sundance variety for the past decade or so, and kind of shaking that up and breaking the mold a little bit by introducing these elements of fantasy, by being sort of boldly emotional, not kind of whispering at you and sort of inviting you to kind of to guess at the psychological state of the characters, but just sort of announcing its vision and sort of putting it all out there in its sloppy glory. I just found it tremendously exciting. I mean, I've seen it a few times and brought my family and just every time walk out with my heart full. And, you know, sometimes even when you're a critic, you have to go with that.
Well, I responded similarly, as I said, at times. But I think where I do agree with you, Michael, a little bit, is that as the film goes on and after the storm and we spend more time with them really trying to survive, where I think the film steers wrong a little bit is it starts to go into, for me, Gone Baby Gone territory. I'm thinking of the Ben Affleck film where he's shooting a film in, you know, working class, really kind of rough part of Boston. And similarly with that film here, it's like Zeitlin works so hard to be genuine and gritty. I actually feel like it kind of goes the other way. It goes so far to such an extreme that he starts to seem like a bit of an outsider. There is a little bit of a tourist element that emerges, I think, as this movie goes on, where his camera just seems to be drawn to the most grotesque and the most absurd the deeper he goes into it.
There could be, although I think we're we may be mischaracterizing Zeitlin's relationship to the place he's filming, because I believe, Tony, isn't this right? He's lived down in and around New Orleans for several years.
Right.
He's part of a kind of a collective of filmmakers, some of whom are like he is from New York, but who have been down there for a long time. And I don't think that that's ever a good yardstick to measure sincerity or authenticity or artistic accomplishment, you know, what someone's personal connection to a place is. But I think that there is a knowledge of place and a sense of place in this movie. I don't think this is, just sort of people kind of blundering into a...
Look, Elia Kazan didn't know much about the Tennessee Valley Authority when he made Wild River, I don't think, and that's a film that's...
Well, I think maybe what I was suggesting with the Affleck connection is, you know, of course, he is from Boston, whether he's from that part or not, and there's almost a sense of, as a director, trying to establish, I know this place really well, and I'm going to show you the deepest, darkest recesses of it. And I think actually there can be a point where you go too far with that. I see that here a little bit.
Here's what I think the most interesting thing I can say about Beasts of the Southern Wild is that it does make me very curious about where he's going to go with his second feature. That, in and of itself, is a good indication that he's got genuine talent. And he may develop in a way that, you know, I continue to resist, and so, just because it's kind of a full frontal attack on material that I think should breathe a little more. It is simply too early to say he's got one style and he's going to stick to it, right or wrong. It's although this film is very, very, very close to his earlier short film, Glory at Sea, right from the overture, the prologue on down.
Right.
But I'm not sure, frankly, he had enough story to tell in the story length he chose, but... You know, Josh, you were going to say something.
Yeah, let's close out with you, Josh.
Adam was just mentioning that towards the end it seems to go towards some more grotesque areas or scenes, but I actually felt the entire thing had this constant tension between filth and beauty throughout the movie that I think Zeitlin does a really good job of balancing. So we see things that are beautiful juxtaposed with something that's ugly, and it kind of asks us whether the beauty is being undercut by this ugliness, or is it encouraging us to always be open to the sublime, even within the ugly? This isn't a movie of uplift by any means, even though you can come out of it with your heart being full, as Tony said. I feel that way too, but it's not because it comes to this sort of triumphant ending. It's just this continual recognition of beauty within a really impoverished community that I appreciated as well.
Well, Michael, Tony, this was an absolute blast. Hopefully we can convince you to come on again sometime.
That'd be a pleasure. This was great.
I don't want to do it with Tony anymore.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about that.
You can't work under these conditions.
It's a stipulation. I love it. Again, thank you very much.
See you, Tony.
Thanks.
Again, that was a real thrill to have Michael and A.O. Scott on the show. Hopefully we can do it again sometime. If you miss Beasts of the Southern Wild in its limited theatrical run, it's available on demand right now. It just came out November 22nd, and it hits DVD and Blu-ray December 4th. So you'll definitely have a few chances to see that film.
Up next, Adam's conversation with writer-director Lynn Shelton about her improvisational style of filmmaking and reteaming with Hump Day star Mark Duplass. Stay with us.
I really like the makeup set. It's the only kind I ever get. And when I'm gazing longingly in your eyes, it's not for you but the self I left behind. Can you believe it? Can you believe it? Can you believe it felt so wrong? Can you believe it? Can you believe it?
Hey folks, Adam here. Hope you're enjoying this Golden Brick preview show. Just wanted to interrupt for a second to share some information about our very valued sponsors here this week on Film Spotting. This episode is brought to you, as you heard initially, by Shutterstock.com. They have over 700,000 high-quality video clips to help you take your creative project to the next level. For 30% off your new account, just go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM11. We're also brought to you by Squarespace.com. This is a website tool that a lot of Film Spotting listeners use, and even more have started to use since we began promoting them on the show at least a year or so ago, if not more. We love sharing your content as testimonials with the Film Spotting audience. So if you have a Squarespace built website that you want to get a little more traffic to, we're happy to try and help you out. Just email us feedback@filmspotting.net and maybe we can feature that in an upcoming Film Spotting show. But what makes Squarespace so great for Film Spotting listeners, our very creative audience out there, whether you're cinematographers or graphic designers or some other kind of visual artist, they have a great new design with templates to showcase your work. It's all drag and drop, very easy to use, and the structure in terms of code is really clean. It's really helpful, especially for search engine optimization. And everything's integrated, so you can get your design, your domains, your hosting and support all there in one place. They also make it so whatever website you build, it will restructure automatically to fit on every device that's trying to access your website and maintain the content and beauty of the site's design. You can also import your content from your current blog and easily set up sharing and syncing with your social media accounts. And if you're one of those listeners out there who wants to start a website, but maybe it's more to feature your writing, maybe you're not a visual artist, their layout engine that builds pages for you so you can create custom layouts for each of your pages in seconds. Go to squarespace.com/film now to set up your account. It's $10 a month for the standard plan and $20 a month for the unlimited plan. If you sign up for an entire year, you automatically get 20% off. And if you sign up for 2 years, you get 25% off. Just don't forget to use the offer code FILM11 to get an additional 10% off during checkout. We certainly thank Squarespace for their support.
I have to tell you.
Yes.
I have to tell you, you behaved improperly today.
How is that?
By making plain your feeling when one of the riders fell. Your conduct was improper. It must not occur again. I have said it before.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. We're previewing candidates for our upcoming Golden Brick Awards. We'll get back to that in a moment. But first, you heard some sound there from Joe Wright's new film, Anna Karenina, obviously an adaptation of Leo Tolstoy's classic novel. It stars Keira Knightley with Jude Law and Aaron Johnson. And that's fodder for this week's Film Spotting poll question. As you recall, last week on the show, we posed to you, which director was the biggest draw for you? Which director with a November Thanksgiving release entices you the most with his work? Your options were Joe Wright, the director of not only Anna Karenina, but the recent film Hannah, and before that, Atonement and Pride and Prejudice, or David O. Russell, whose current film is Silver Linings Playbook. He also directed The Fighter and my favorite one of his films, Three Kings. We want to know which of those two directors excites you the most with his work. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. Looking back at our Golden Brick candidates, the ones we mentioned in the previous segment, some of the early contenders for our nominees, and ultimately we'll name a winner in December, movies that basically flew under the radar that we think deserve more attention, and in large part got some attention because of our recommendations. One film that doesn't quite fit into that category, but is a very good film and does definitely deserve more attention, is Oslo, August 31. That's the one film of all the ones we mentioned previously that really didn't get any time at all on the show, but it's a film I recommended via Twitter, and listeners who follow Film Spotting at Film Spotting on Twitter, many of them saw that recommendation and did seek out the film because of it. Even though it didn't get any time in the main show, we actually did discuss it briefly with A.O. Scott on that show from July. It's a film he's a big fan of. So why don't we go ahead and replay that here? This is, of course, before I had had a chance to see the movie, but here's what A.O. Scott thought then.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, it's definitely a mood piece. You know, it's very quiet and somber and precise. And, you know, it's based on a novel that was filmed before by Louis Malle, I think in the late 50s or early 60s. And, You know, there have been a lot of movies about addiction, and it's sort of not an unfamiliar topic. But I think it's one that stayed with me. You know, it's very subtle. It's very intense. It goes in some surprising directions. And the character, it's just fascinating because he's not easy to relate to. You don't really know how you feel about him through a lot of the movie, and yet you're always paying attention to him. You're always with him. I think that's a tribute to Trier's direction and also to Lee's performance, which is very quiet and recessive, but also charismatic in a way.
Alt glemmes.
Alt.
Alt.
Hvorfor?
Det er en slags naturlov.
En regn.
Ja.
Of all the films we mentioned, Oslo, August 31 is really the only film that didn't get any attention at all in the main show. It's the new film from Norwegian director Joachim Trier. It follows a young man as he's being released from a drug rehabilitation program. And basically we see 24 hours or so, or 48 hours in his life as he goes out into the world and looks for a job and tries to make amends or try to have some closure with a few people, friends and family from his life. It's a really powerful film, and it's a movie that's available via Netflix streaming, and it's certainly one that could be a contender for our Golden Brick as we get to that list in December. Another candidate for that list of Golden Brick nominees, a movie we will definitely throw into the mix as we review our options, is Your Sister's Sister, directed by Lynn Shelton, who I spoke with this past June.
I miss you. I miss my friend.
Oh, this is that moment, isn't it?
This is your intervention. Whatever you think is helping you, I have a responsibility as your friend to tell you that it's not.
Just tell me what to do.
You know that nice red bicycle that you have?
Yes.
You're going to dust off old red, and you're going to get on a ferry. I'm sending you to my dad's place. There's no TV, there's no internet, there's nothing. It's just you.
Do they have forks?
It's just you and... We have a couple of forks, yeah.
I might need to stab myself in the face.
Sorry. I think I'm in the wrong house, and I... Hey, you're Hannah. Oh, my God. I'm so sorry. I'm Iris's friend, Jack.
Actually, I want to apologize. I hate to start by asking you questions about Mark Duplass, but I want to go back to the beginning of this film, kind of the origin, because I understand he kind of came to you with the initial setup anyway. So
he did.
How did that work? What did he bring to you, and what got you interested in this film, in this idea?
We'd been looking for a way to collaborate again because we'd had such a good time on Hump Day, and I think we're a good match in the creative process. And so, you know, he has this vault of movies that he and his brother Jay may turn into a movie, you know, movies someday in the future. But this one felt a little too close to home because at the center there was a guy who had recently lost his brother, and that just felt like probably something they wouldn't want to be tackling anytime soon. But he still thought it was a great kernel for a story. So he called and said, here's what I got. It's a guy and a girl. They're best friends. He's in a bad place because he's lost his brother recently. She sends him up to her family's getaway to kind of get some alone time. And there he meets her hot young mother. So I changed the mom to an older sister. And not so much because I thought that the mother wouldn't provide some interesting, you know, interesting opportunities. I'm sure that would make a great movie as well. But I really liked the idea that there were these two parallel sets of sibling relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Because the fourth character in the movie is the dead brother who you never meet physically, but he weighs so heavily on Jack's soul and also weighs heavily on the relationship between he and his best friend, because his best friend Iris, played by Emily Blunt, once was in a relationship with Tom, the dead brother. So there's that kind of interesting, there's like a love triangle there already. And then these two parallel relationships, complicated sister relationship, very complicated brother relationship, and it informs how he interacts with the two women. So, yeah, I just thought that would be really interesting territory. So,
you mentioned that you and Mark are a good match, and I'm curious, what makes you a good match, and how did you connect with him originally? I'm a fan of his work as a director and as an actor in your films, and he just seems like one of those guys who could be either the guy at the party who's the coolest guy in the room, funny, smart, engaging, or he can be the guy like he is at the start of this film, kind of off in the corner, lost and completely hapless and not wanting to mingle with anybody. So there's some dynamics there that you can play with Mark a little bit.
Oh, my God. He's got tremendous range as an actor, for sure. And he's very vanity free, which is important to me as a director. I love unvain actors. He's just really interested in the truth. You know, I mean, that's, I think, the thing that bonds us is that we're both, our guiding light is authenticity and credibility and making sure that the characters that are being portrayed on film are on screen are not just sort of cardboard cutout replicas of humans, but are actual real feeling mm-hmm. human beings. And we sort of hit the ground running. You know, when we first met, we were sort of primed to meet each other. We had a mutual friend several mutual friends, but the main one was Joe Swanberg. I'd met Joe in the 2006 Maryland Film Festival. He was there with the second feature film, LOL, and I was there with A Week Away Back, my first feature. And he was just about to start working with Mark on Hannah Takes the Stairs and told me, oh, you got to see The Puffy Chair. And so Mark ended up coming, I think it was 2007, he came to Seattle, which is where I live, to shoot a movie. He was starring in a film called True Adolescence by Craig Johnson. And I volunteered to be a set photographer for a few days on that film, basically so I could meet and hopefully bond with Mark Duplass. And I remember we both knew of each other and we saw each other for the very first time, like down this path. I remember I was walking towards the beach and he was coming towards me. As soon as we saw who we were,
yeah,
we both just sort of flung open our arms and we just had this huge bear hug. And that was kind of like, I don't know, it was like from the get-go. I just remember really bonding with him right away. We just had a real kinship in terms of how we like to make movies. We didn't want mm-hmm. to wait around for permission to do it. You know, we wanted to just be able to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and make our own movies. And we also really felt strongly that the more freedom, you know, you're able to give actors on set in terms of how the dialogue comes out of their mouths, you know, the more naturalistic a performance you're going to get. And we really love the idea of that true kind of collaboration. And I think he's very different as a director, actually, than I am as a director, although I haven't had an opportunity to see mm-hmm. him on set that much. But at any rate, I just, as him as an actor and me as a director, I feel like we just, it's a good match, good fit.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking with writer-director Lynn Shelton about her new film, Your Sister's Sister, and specifically her collaboration with the star of that film, Mark Duplass. And it's interesting because this is your second time in a row working with him, thinking of Hump Day. And I've been trying all morning here to come up with a clever spin on this question because I'm sure you've heard it a million times. It's probably the most common one you get, but at least your last three films, going back to My Effortless Brilliance. And I think that probably safe to say those are the three where you've been working kind of in the same similar approach, same style in how you come at the film. You've really focused on male characters, not to undermine what happens with female characters. Certainly in this film, Your Sister's Sister, Emily Blunt's character and Rosemarie DeWitt are key figures. And certainly the wife, Alicia Delmore, in Hump Day, I think that movie is just as much a husband and wife story, if not more, than it is the friendship story. That all said, Mark's character, the male characters, are kind of what drive the film forward. I'm curious if there's something in you as a woman that draws you to telling male stories.
You know, I'm going to answer the way that Mike Lee answers when people say, you keep making these wonderful movies about female characters with really real feeling female characters. And he says, I don't make movies about women. I make movies about people. Yeah. And it really is true for me. Those three films all have one thing in common, which is that I had to come at them as a sociologist, sort of from the outside in, because I didn't have direct personal experience being in a straight male friendship or being in a complicated sibling relationship either. Because I don't know if I would say that the movie, I think it's as much about Jack as it is about the sisters, but I really feel like that's a huge, for me, the sister relationship is a very, very key one. But my relationships with my siblings are incredibly uncomplicated and boring and just sort of pure love. And so they're unfettered by a lot of baggage or layers of jealousies or competition, at least on my end. You'd have to ask my siblings how they feel about me. But on my part, I didn't feel like I could draw on personal experience as much. But I've observed around me, I do have to say, I'm a pretty good people watcher and have always been compelled and fascinated by the human condition and by the dynamics of interpersonal relationships. Mm-hmm. And I have noticed these incredibly layered, convoluted, complicated, deep, you know, textured relationships between siblings where there's this incredible bond and this desire and deep need to connect, but it's complicated by all kinds of, you know, just resentments and jealousies and sort of held, you know, resentments that are held onto long after betrayals, mm-hmm. have, you know, from the past have happened. And you know, I keep coming back again and again to relationships. I'm really moved by when people try to connect with each other and they can't because of whatever obstructions. And that straight male friendship is a nice territory for that. I think, you know, it's a little bit more complicated for straight guys to tell each other, you know, the basic I love you, man, kind of thing. The I love you has to be qualified by the man.
Right.
Anyway, and
the bro hug.
The bro hug. Yeah, exactly. And it's always a little awkward. And, you know, and for certain siblings, I think it's the same kind of thing. So I'm always drawn to that kind of territory, you know.
Yeah, you seem particularly drawn to these interpersonal dynamics and characters trying to connect in a confined space. You like to throw people together either for the first time or often they're reuniting and there's some baggage there and they're coming together. Is that just obvious? It makes for good drama when tensions kind of build up and there's kind of this claustrophobia.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That tension, they're chamber pieces, I guess, you know. Mm-hmm. People have pointed out to me that they'd make good plays, and they do tend to take place. I've made 3 movies in a row now with 3 characters and basically one location. And basically all over the course of a long weekend, for the most part, you know, there's a little bit of extra time at the end of Your Sister, but the bulk of the drama happens over the course of about 3 days. And that kind of confined space creates this microcosmic opportunity for the audience to really get to know these characters and to see all of them, their flaws mm-hmm. and their weaknesses, and hopefully be rooting for them in spite of that. Maybe because of that, you know, because they recognize that they're just as human as the, you know, we are ourselves.
Well, that confined space also brings out this communal aspect of filmmaking. You guys kind of go to camp when you make these films. You go into this house or wherever the setting is and basically have to live together. How much of that is just by necessity in order to make these films, limited budget, limited production schedule? And how much of it is, as you kind of said, wanting to play sociologist a little bit? I mean, you kind of get to do that as you're in the room observing how they are as people.
It's really, really wonderful. To me, it's the ideal way to make a film is to kidnap a group of collaborators and go off to some remote place, because you never stop working. I mean, you do stop working, but your off time, your off hours are feeding directly into what's going to happen the next day on set. It's really beautiful. And, you know, remarkably, somebody said, well, don't people want to get away, you know? And generally not. I mean, they can. There's places that they can go secrete themselves.
You don't have them
away,
chained to the radiator,
no.
Is what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. They're all held hostage, and yet they seem to be willing victims. Yeah, there's something that happens on set that's so intimate and so wonderful that we can't wait to just, you know, have a home-cooked meal together and all, you know, and everybody. I'm talking about the crew and the cast. I mean, there were a total of 16 people, including the actors. So really, it was a very tight little community. And it really is, you're right, camp is a very good, it's like film camp.
You know?
And we're working our asses off, but it's really very fun, too.
You're listening to Film Spotting, talking with writer-director Lynn Shelton. Her new movie is Your Sister's Sister. Another motif I've noticed that occurs throughout your work so far is the conversation. This element of this really fiery moment where these people who are either connecting or reconnecting come together and often make a decision that it definitely drives the whole rest of the film forward. And often it's something they come to regret a little bit. And for me, those conversations are just as good as watching a car chase. I mean, that's really why I respond to your films, because I love just watching the dynamics of that. And so the conversation here, you have Rosemarie DeWitt, who is the sister to Jack's best friend, played by Emily Blunt. This is their conversation that first night at this cabin they're staying at.
One thing in common with your little sister?
What, the lush factor?
The self-aware lush factor.
Oh.
Very important. Mm. Big difference. So, you're on an island. It's 3 a.m. and you're drinking by yourself.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Really?
I'm not good for small talk, so I apologize if I'm barging through the doors of your privacy right now.
Yeah, it's okay. You kind of are, but
I apologize. Let's talk about your slippers.
It starts out with a really interesting dynamic where they're a little bit at odds. They're not really connecting. Why are they in this place? Why are they both here? And then you, over the course of this montage and this great dialogue they have, get them to a really interesting place. Not only do they come around and begin to befriend each other, but they also end up in a position I won't say, but it's completely unthinkable at the start of the conversation. So what I'm curious about is just that conversation piece, particularly with this film. How do you approach it? How do you shoot that kind of scene?
Well, it's really easy. The shooting of it is, you know, technically I have 2 cameras. And I have one over the, you know, the shoulder of each actor. And we use two cameras. For the most part, I'd say 95% of the film is shot with two cameras, especially all those conversational pieces. And the thing that's beautiful about that is that you can go off script, because my movies are, I mean, I would say this one is probably 80% improvised. The dialogue is 80% improvised, and then 20% of what I wrote on the page remains pretty much intact. So I wrote, in this case, a 70-page scriptment, I call it.
Uh-huh.
There were some scenes that were sketchier than others, but for the most part, they were all written. A lot of dialogue was written out, basically for the purpose of giving the actresses, the female actors who had not, were not veteran improvisers, as Mark was, just a sense of emotional safety, that they wasn't just throwing them out there without a safety net. They had, if they liked a line, they could certainly, should feel free to use it. But when I approach improvisation, I really want everybody to know exactly what the point of every scene is, how the scenes are all going to add up. It's not like we're sort of showing up on set and saying, you know, not only are you going to entertain us now by being clever and, you know, but also we're going to figure out what the movie is on set. You know, we really know. It's very, very structured and very sort of pointed. So, yeah, we're all on the same page. We don't rehearse, because oftentimes with improv, the very first take is the best. So you basically want to be shooting the rehearsal. But we'll talk ad nauseum to make sure everybody's on the same page and we know what the emotional trajectory, where they have to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll just turn the cameras on and say, are you ready? Go, you know. And then what's lovely, too, is that in the edit room, they know that I'm going to be able to find the best stuff. And so if parts of it, if they try something and they fall on their face, it doesn't matter. They can pick themselves up and keep going. There can be moments where it meanders, or it's sort of, it's like maybe, I remember Emily saying, I remember distinctly there were moments when it felt like it must be watching like paint dry, you know, just incredibly boring. But they have the trust, hopefully, in me that I'm not going to let any, I'm not going to let them, they're not going to look bad on film. So at the end of the take, I'll let them go through the whole scene usually, and then I'll give them some notes and we'll go at it again. And we don't have an endless amount of time. We only shot this thing in 12 days.
Right.
So usually there's only enough time for, I'm hoping to get what I need in about three takes, and then we'll do a fourth as a safety. Occasionally, we'll have to go more, but usually it's pretty concise. You know, it's a pretty efficient process, and I don't know, somehow it all works. And, you know, I started as an editor, so I'm clocking in the back of my brain, okay, do I have enough ingredients in there among the four takes?
Right.
You know, that I don't need a perfect take, because I'm going to be mixing and matching, and you just sort of feel your way. And it's stressful. You know, I worked on Mad Men just the summer before I shot this film, and it was so lovely to have an entire script, like all the dialogue, and it was so beautifully written, and oh my God, this
is just
luxury.
You were rethinking everything now.
Exactly, and it's like, what am I doing trying to write on set? But when it works, it's so exhilarating, and there are these moments that just, I could never have written, you know? I just, dialogue that comes out in a way that just is so natural,
mm-hmm.
or moments where the actors will surprise each other. You know, Mark loves to, all the actors did it, but there's just this element of actual action and reaction where
right.
you're reacting, because you have to be engaged. You have to be there. You're not saving it up for your close up. You don't know what's coming out next. So there's just an electricity that happens with improv that I think will always keep me coming back.
We're talking with Lynn Shelton, the writer-director of the new film, Your Sister's Sister. And tell me if I'm crazy, but there's actually one of those moments in that conversation where I wonder if you were employing one of those old editor's tricks, where there's a great line at one point in the montage where Rosemary DeWitt says something like, you were going for something, or you were on a roll and I cut you off. And that seemed to me one of those moments where it was probably, even though it worked perfectly for the characters, that was probably really Rosemary, the actress, saying that to Mark, the actor, and it worked in the final take. Am I on to anything there at all? And how often do you kind of go for those moments that just spring up?
In all honesty, that I distinctly remember that moment, and it was definitely, she was definitely in character
really?
At that moment. Yeah, for sure. But I'm glad it felt so natural.
It feels
it
spontaneous, like
yeah.
The whole film does, of course,
yeah.
if it's working right, and it does.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. It's, I mean, I'm always open to happy accidents like that. But what I'm looking for is the kind of collaboration with actors that allow them to feel as if their character is like a glove, like they're just able to slip into it like a hand into a mm-hmm. glove. And there's so much overlap with themselves, not that they're playing themselves, but they're able to bring their own cadences, you know, as human beings and their own personalities to the fore in a way that it's just second nature when they open their mouths, and what comes out is just second nature. And having an an enormous amount of backstory, which I've developed with them over the course of several months, helps enormously as well. And they're heavily asked for a lot of involvement mm-hmm. in that process, and I think it really helps.
You talked earlier about structure. You've talked about it quite a bit. And that was one of the things that really drew me to Hump Day, and I don't even want to bring up the word mumblecore. I was trying to get through this whole interview without doing it, but it's one of those things where something about Hump Day really grabbed me because it seemed like it was bringing the best aspects of mumblecore in terms of that kind of improvisational approach and these characters where the actors have clearly invested themselves and there's just this great naturalness and there's an urgency with the camera. And Hump Day, there's a lot of close-ups and, again, really making use of that confined space. But at the same time, there is that structure. There is a sense that there's always a roadmap, that there is something clearly defined where these characters are going. So how important is that to you, to have that structure in place from the beginning?
Oh, it's incredibly important to me. I really, with Hump Day in particular, I remember my goal was I wanted to make a movie that felt like that really great movie-going experience where you're on the edge of your seat. You know, at the end of every scene, you're wondering, oh, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? And it just driving you through or sort of pulling you through, you know, the narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'm a real control freak. So the collaborative process with both the crew and the cast is extremely terrifying and ever exhilarating for me. I didn't come into my own as an artist. I've been an artist my whole life, but I didn't come into my own until I discovered that collaborative process. But I am still enough of a control freak that I can't leave the structure up to, you know, I have to know what's going to be coming down the pike,
right,
you know, and what the point of every scene is and that it's all going to add up in the end. So the improv aspect of it, I like to employ in how the actual words are going to be formed. Again, it's all in the quest of naturalism, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if a line is working, great, but that's fine too. You know, I don't have anything against the written line. It's just I'm really looking for that sense of authenticity. But structure's, yeah, incredibly important to me.
Where do you think you're at right now in terms of your process as a director? Do you feel like it's really continuing to evolve and taking big steps? Are you refining a process that you feel really comfortable with and kind of want to keep mining the nuance of it? Where's that at right now?
Well, what's interesting is that I actually just wrapped a film about 2.5 weeks ago called Touchy Feely. And the way I made this movie is a divergence from my last three films, which are all three characters in one location over the course of a long day weekend. I really wanted to break out of that. I felt like, okay, I really want to try something. I want to see if I can employ some of these same, you know, the same quest for naturalism, but maybe have a little more control mm-hmm. over the script and a little bit more of an elaborate intertwining of multiple storylines and different, even more characters, scenarios and so on. So it was inspired partially, I think, working on Mad Men, actually, and having such a positive experience working with a script word perfectly. And then also working with Rose and Emily, who are more used to working with text as the spine of their performances. And so I wrote a script with, you know, many characters, and it's got Ellen Page and Rose Marie again in it, and Josh Pice, Ron Livingston, Allison Janney, Scoot McNairy. So it's lots of people, lots of storylines, and it's a real combination of drama and comedy. It's shot a little differently than my last few films. I mean, I think it'll still feel like a Lynn Shelton film, but it's
right.
Really is a divergence structurally. And I just needed to break out.
Yeah.
But it's funny because I had lots of locations and lots of people. It was a longer shoot. It was 20 whole days. And I immediately started yearning for that chamber piece, bare bones, microcosmic, yeah, scenario again. The thing about it is that the more complicated that your films get in terms, you know, visually and location-wise mm-hmm. and so on, the more time you spend during production on technical stuff and the less time you're able to just be in it,
yeah,
in the room with the actors, finding the scene and really finding the truth of the scene. And that's what gets me going as a filmmaker. As a film goer, I actually am incredibly inspired. I mean, I'm a total sucker for visual beauty. I love elaborate, really beautiful cinematic language. But on set, I have to say, I'd much rather be in the mix, in the mm-hmm. swamp, you know, working with the actors on that stuff, as opposed to setting up, you know, hours setting up the perfect crane shot. I don't know. I mean, I want to try everything, and I'm really happy to be able to work in those bigger opportunity, you know, in those bigger ways. But I think I'm always going to be drawn back to that,
yeah,
to that sort of bare bones scenario.
This is what I think. We'll have a second round.
Okay.
You get all the right ingredients.
Uh-huh.
I'll make my pancakes. You make yours, and we'll have like a pancake off. And then whoever wins will win like a
trip to IHOP.
A trip to IHOP, but make sure you bring your passport because it's international.
Right. Yeah.
That was my conversation with writer-director Lynn Shelton from this past summer. Her film Your Sister's Sister just came out on DVD earlier this month.
That's it for our Golden Brick preview. Please send any comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
We'll be back next week in our usual format with a roundup of three November releases, Silver Linings Playbook, Anna Karenina, and the new James Bond film, Skyfall. We'll also get to the fourth film in our Blaxploitation marathon, Black Caesar. Right now, the top five is up for grabs. We don't have one locked in yet.
Taking suggestions?
Always taking suggestions. feedback@filmspotting.net.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.